Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Donald Trump's tweet storm attacking the Republican chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Bob Corker, who replied by tweeting, "It's a shame the White House has become an adult daycare center. Somebody obviously missed their shift this morning." Derek Shearer, a former U.S. ambassador to Finland, who is currently a professor of diplomacy and world affairs at Occidental College, where he serves as director of the McKinnon Center for Global Affairs, joins us to discuss the state of U.S. diplomacy and Corker's fear Trump is treating the presidency like a reality show and is steering the U.S. on a path to World War III. We will assess whether Senator Corker's warning that Trump, quote, concerns me, he would have to concern anyone who cares about our nation, will prompt other Republican senators to express in public what they say in private, since Corker's apparently not alone in being alarmed about Trump, claiming, quote, the vast majority of our caucus understands what we're dealing with here. Then Wendy Young, the executive director of KIND, Kids in Need of Defense, the leading organization for the unaccompanied children who enter the U.S. immigration system alone, joins us to look into the cynical game Donald Trump is playing by tying the fate of the 800,000 DACA dreamers to a hardline wish list that is dead on arrival with Democrats, who Trump can then blame for the failure of immigration reform. We'll discuss how Trump again throws red meat to his base as a way to distract from his failure to govern by insisting on building his wall, hiring 10,000 more Border Patrol, denying federal funds to sanctuary cities, and closing the door on thousands of children fleeing violence in Central America. Then finally, we'll explore the growing tyranny of the minority in America as an increasingly unpopular president whose approval rating continues to shrink throws the full weight of his administration behind satisfying the wish lists of right-wing extremists and religious zealots. Gretchen Borschelt, Vice President for Reproductive Rights and Health at the National Women's Law Center, joins us to discuss how the vast majority of American women can now be denied birth control coverage in order to satisfy a vocal minority of anti-abortionists who have succeeded in making abortions more likely, numerous, and frequent. And joining us now is Derek Shearer, a former U.S. ambassador to Finland, who is currently a professor of diplomacy and world affairs at Occidental College, where he serves as director of the McKinnon Center for Global Affairs. Welcome to Background Briefing, Derek Shearer.
Thank you, Ian.
And from the perspective of a former U.S. diplomat, what do you make of this exchange between President Trump and Senator Corker, the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, where Trump tweeted out basically attacking Corker, saying he begged me to endorse him. He wanted to be Secretary of State. I said, no, thanks. He's largely responsible for the horrendous Iran deal. He didn't have the guts to run, etc. And then Corker replied, it's a shame the White House has become an adult daycare center. Someone obviously missed their shift this morning. And then, of course, subsequently, he had a long conversation, Senator Corker, with the New York Times. But let's start with that exchange. Have you seen anything like this?
Well, I think the fact is we've seen something like this from day one in the Trump administration. I mean, this is a president who conducts policy, we'll put in quotes, by tweeting. And a president who needs to be reassured by all these, in quotes, powerful men around him that he is the smartest and the best, and if they don't pay obeisance or suck up to him or criticize them, he goes on the attack. And it doesn't matter whether it's a prominent U.S. senator or the head of another country. I mean, this is Trump's modus operandi, so I'm not surprised by it at all.
Well, but Senator Corker did say in his New York Times interview that he is not alone, that in fact, he said all the Republican caucus in the Senate, his fellow Republicans all feel this way, that this president is out of control and is dangerous and could start World War III. So why is it that he's the only one speaking out?
Well, Ian, I mean, you could raise this question about the Republican Party on many issues. I mean, we saw it around Charlottesville when, you know, few of them would really stand up and speak out, including, you know, his top economic advisors who were standing there with him, like Gary Cohn or Steve Mnuchin. They have not yet decided that it's worse for them to dump Trump than to keep him. I mean, from their point of view, the point of view of the Republican Party, he's carrying out much of their agenda, especially in domestic affairs. You know, he's appointing very conservative judges and U.S. attorneys. He's ripping up regulations in all the formerly regulated industries, including environment. You know, he's bringing down as much as he can the force of law on immigration issues. So he's following Republican policy. The one place where he deviates is in foreign policy, where he is not as internationalist or as much, you know, pro-free trade. But that's not a big voting issue for Republican voters. It's an issue for elites like Bob Corker. And so I hear this all the time from friends in State Department, from people who are both Republicans and Democrats, about how disastrous it is to American foreign policy, to our soft power abroad, to our relations with particular countries. I mean, I can give you many examples. I recently had dinner with Vicente Fox, the former president of Mexico, whom you may know has gone on YouTube attacking President Trump about U.S.-Mexico relations, which are at an all-time low. So none of it surprises me, and I guess I don't expect anything of the Republican leadership. They have made their deal with Trump, the fact that they supported him as his candidate, and they're going to stick with him until it gets so bad that they have no other choice, and that would have to be losing control of the House or Senate in the midterms, or I think much more likely is when the Mueller investigation is finished, which is going to be quite thorough and I think going to be quite bad for Trump. And that might provide enough kind of factual ammunition that they'll finally decide they've had enough. But until then, they put up with it.
But it's one thing to be bad for Trump, but Trump could be bad for the country, if not the world. Senator Corker saying that he could put the U.S. on a course for World War III. He said, I know for a fact that every single day at the White House, it's a situation of trying to contain him. And that's what I understand is going on, that the adults, the generals, try to contain him, and he just keeps insisting he wants to bomb Kim Jong-un, and they keep saying there aren't any military options, and he keeps coming back at them. But he does have the nuclear codes, and as far as I understand, there's no impediment between the president and the use of those nuclear codes. I mean, if the country's attacked, the chain of command through the Secretary of Defense would say, you know, you have to respond. But he can wake up on the wrong side of the bed and with the football beside him and order a nuclear attack. That, as far as I know, is a fact. So I think, isn't that the real overriding issue? Isn't that what Senator Corker is trying to warn us about?
Yes, I think that's what he's trying to warn us about. But he is, again, not the first person, you know, to say this. And I mean, Senator McCain has spoken out and some others who care about foreign policy in the Republican Party. But I don't think, you know, it's as bad as the notion that Trump's going to wake up in the morning, you know, and lose it and start a nuclear war. It is true that he respects, you know, again in quotes, generals, and he does not boss Mathis around. Mathis stays away from the White House as much as possible. The guy who has the hard job is General McMaster, who runs the National Security Council, because he's the one who's trying to impose some rationality on the foreign policy process, and also General Kelly, who's now Chief of Staff. My understanding, I just was recently in Washington from friends who work on the National Security Council, is that that process is pretty broken, that they can't get Trump to read anything longer than a few sentences. He'll listen to some oral briefings, but he doesn't really pay attention. He doesn't have any base of foreign policy. He's not all that interested in the intricacies, and he loves to make these outrageous tweets. But I don't think he's actually going to start a war all by himself. I think much more, you know, dangerous is a situation probably in the Korean Peninsula or possibly with China, that gets escalated where there are miscalculations on both sides, and then you have Trump making the decision. So, as I say, I think he's not going to all by himself start a war. I think he's a lot of talk and little action.
And again, I'm speaking with Derek Shearer, who's a former U.S. ambassador to Finland, who is currently a professor of diplomacy and world affairs at Occidental College, where he serves as director of the McKinnon Center for Global Affairs. But nevertheless, he is saying stuff in front of the entire world body at the United Nations, talking about totally destroying a member country, North Korea. And, of course, he's been tweeting out all kinds of implications of military action, saying that they don't. There's only one thing that they understand, implying military force. My understanding about international diplomacy and going back to the Cold War is that perceptions are what it's all about. We see ourselves as virtuous, but on the other side, the Soviets, for example, back in November of 83, thought we were planning to attack them, and they almost went to launch a nuclear war over a military exercise in NATO because of the perceptions based upon, for example, Ronald Reagan talking about the Soviet Union ending up on the ash heap of history, something they took literally. So as bad as the gerontocracy was in the Kremlin, as somebody like Kim Jong-un, who has murdered his own half-brother, murdered his uncle, used VX gas on killing his own half-brother, runs a kind of religious cult where, if you read on Sunday's New York Times, Nick Kristof was in North Korea and said all the generals in the military types are absolutely giddy, with drunk with anticipating a nuclear war, which they think they're going to win. So you have these delusional people over there. You should not be taunting these people, surely.
Well, look, I agree with you. I don't think he should be conducting American foreign policy this way. All I'm trying to say is, I mean, if you just look at the practical situation in the Korean Peninsula, Mathis and McMaster and Kelly are well aware of the American troops who are sitting in South Korea, let alone in Japan. So it's not as if, well, okay, let's have an exchange of, you know, conventional or nuclear weapons in Korea and we'll just kill a bunch of Koreans and who cares, which is kind of what Trump seems to be saying. It would kill a lot of Americans. And so there is no way that the generals around him are going to do that kind of thing lightly, or if at all. And if they do anything, it's much more likely to be a very targeted, semi-clandestine operation. Now, the problem of those things, of course, is always escalation. But I just, you know, I think this is the way Trump operates. A lot of it is bluff and bluster. It's very hurtful to America's, we call, soft power and influence abroad. There is no real rational foreign policy being conducted right now by the United States. But politically, the Republican Party is going to live with it, as I argued earlier, until the domestic cost to the party is greater than the gains they think they're getting. And so, and you know, Corker's leaving, so what do they care? You know, some senator, I mean, most of the senators would even defend McCain when Trump attacked his war record. So I don't hold the current Republican leadership in very high regard for, you know, courage or morality or really caring about America's role in the world. I think they want to keep their hold on power.
Well, but I'm not so much concerned that Trump's going to order a nuclear attack on North Korea. The generals clearly would somehow contain him, at least. That's what Corker's saying. But I'm worried about Kim Jong-un thinking this guy has said in front of the UN that he wants to totally destroy us. He's basically said that the only thing we understand is military power, and maybe we should preempt the inevitable attack.
Well, again, that would be the end of North Korea, and they know it. Mm-hmm. And we do have other channels. We do talk to the North Koreans in various ways, some of which I can't, you know, discussed publicly, but some of which have been reported. I mean, Evan Osnos did the best article on North Korea after his visit in the New Yorker. He'd been our New York or Beijing correspondent. And there are North Koreans, including the North Korean ambassador to the UN, who do speak with us. You know, so there are avenues of discussion. It's not as if it's all down to Kim Jong-un. And he's been highly rational about maximizing his own power. Starting a war would end his life and his power. So, you know, I don't think that is a scenario that I think is very likely, that he's just going to shoot a missile at us that may or may not even reach us and then have himself wiped off the face of the earth. So this is what would happen.
Well, he may test a missile at any moment because their major holiday is, of course, yeah, October the 10th, Foundation Day, as they call it. There's some rumor that we may try to shoot it down. I don't know.
Well, we might, and they might, you know, test it near Guam. And again, it's not a situation I think is good, and I also think it's a dangerous situation. But I don't think it's kind of World War III scenario, because the Chinese don't want this to happen for obvious reasons. The last thing the Chinese want are nuclear weapons going off in their neighborhood. But their major concern is, you know, stability and economic growth, and it's certainly not what Japan or South Korea want. So there are a lot of other players in this game that are trying to restrain Trump in various ways. But I'm not saying it's good, and I think it's, you know, I'm amused by the exchange with Corker, but I don't think it's going to change the way Trump runs the White House, and I don't think a lame duck senator is going to change the Republican Party. It's going to have to be something pretty dramatic. As I say, I think the Mueller report will have some very dramatic things in it that might lead to possible moves towards impeachment, in which case I think Trump would quit rather than stay, or if they suffer big losses in the midterm, because they'd be, you know, the Republicans privately all say they'd be very happy with Pence. They're just not willing to try and make it happen yet.
Well, just in closing then, if indeed the Mueller investigation is as damaging as some people expect, one aspect of it, of course, is the son-in-law, Jared Kushner, whose apparently advice was to fire the FBI director because he thought that somehow the Democrats would like that. And that, of course, has proven to be a real problem that brought about the Mueller investigation in the first place. There are also rumors, it's established that the Saudis gave Ivanka Trump, Jared's wife, $100 million for her foundation. And my understanding is that Jared Kushner is being using his position as Trump's diplomat, an envoy for all things around the world, including Middle East peace, etc., to shake down the Saudis and the Qataris, of all people, for money for his failed building on 666 Fifth Avenue that's been underwater since he bought it.
Ian...
Will that be in the report, do you think? I mean,
I think that, again, the Mueller investigation is looking at all of these economic conflicts of interest. I mean, they're multiple, not just with Jared Kushner's businesses, but with the Trump ongoing businesses. I mean, many of his buildings have been financed by Russian money for many years. I think people are going to be both surprised and shocked at how thorough this Mueller investigation is. He's got some of the top prosecutors and investigators in the country working on this. And I, you know, that's where I would be optimistic, if I'm going to be an optimist about the situation we're in, is that I think that investigation could mean that Trump's not going to serve 4 years. Now, hopefully we get out of the less than 4 years without a war in the Korean Peninsula or anywhere else. And for that, I think we do still have to trust the rationality and strength of the generals around him.
Well, it would be an extraordinary thing to see Donald Trump go from the White House to a federal penitentiary, a perp warp in an orange jumpsuit across the White House lawn. That would be something to behold.
You know, I'd be happy just to have him return to Mar-a-Lago.
Well, on that note, Ambassador Scherer, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Derek Shearer, former U.S. ambassador to Finland, who's currently a professor of diplomacy and world affairs at Occidental College, where he serves as director of the McKinnon Center for Global Affairs. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the cynical game Donald Trump is playing, tying the fate of 800,000 DACA dreamers to his hardline wish list on immigration.
Well, some people try and treat me like a man. Yeah, some people try and treat me like a man. Well, I guess they just don't understand. Yeah, some people try and treat me like a man. They think I know, but that's just it, I'm a child.
I am a poor wayfaring stranger, traveling through this world alone. There's no sickness, toil or danger in that bright land to which I go. I'm going there to see my mother.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Wendy Young, the Executive Director of KIND, Kids in Need of Defense, the leading organization for the protection of unaccompanied children who enter the U.S. immigration system alone. Previously, she served as Chief Counsel on Immigration Policy in the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on Immigration, Border Security, and Refugees, and held immigration policy positions with the United Nations High Commissioner of Refugees, the Women's Refugee Commission, the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, and the National Council of La Raza. Welcome to Background Briefing, Wendy Young.
Thank you.
And it seems as though the White House, and I believe Stephen Miller has a hand in this, along with Donald Trump, who delivered a letter to Congress on Sunday, a list of really hardline measures that Trump's demanding in exchange for whether or not he'll protect the DACA students, the Dreamers. And he basically is using the jeopardy of 800,000 young immigrants brought here as children as leverage to construct a wall along the southern border, to deny federal grants to sanctuary cities, and to hire another 10,000 immigration agents to strengthen the border against thousands of children fleeing violence in Central America. So this is a real poison pill, is it not, for the Democrats?
Yes, that's right. This is a so-called deal that's really dead in the water, Ian, because he has proposed so many harsh changes to our immigration laws that would literally harm tens of thousands of people, that it really is, it's not a starting point for a negotiation or a discussion. And I think you're seeing the reaction from Democrats on the Hill exactly along those lines. You know, everybody's united in their desire to provide some kind of status to the Dreamer community. These are young people who've lived here for years, are contributing to society, they're going to college, they're joining the military, and they're really a part of the very fabric of our society. So they deserve protection and they deserve status. But doing that on the backs of unaccompanied children who are seeking protection in the United States, doing that on the back of family members who are seeking to reunite with family members and bring them to the United States, doing that on the back of refugees who are in need of resettlement, it's a non-starter.
But is that a deliberate strategy on Trump's part to make it a non-starter? In other words, to shift the blame, saying, I tried, and the Democrats are the problem, not me.
Yeah, you have to believe that there's some kind of motivation along those lines, because this is so not a serious effort on the part of the administration. And many of the ideas that they're promoting have been advanced for numerous, numerous years in Congress and been rejected. So you have to think it was just kind of thumbing their nose at Congress and, as you say, trying to lay the blame there.
So given that this is a part of the theater, and we have the senator in charge of the Foreign Relations Committee basically saying that the president runs the White House like a reality TV show, and that, he's expressed alarm, in fact, that Donald Trump could start World War III. That in itself is pretty extraordinary. None of his colleagues, even though Corker says in private that they all agree with him, they don't seem to be ready to speak out about their concerns about this reckless person in the White House. So at what point do you think we're going to, I mean, imagine the press are going to be asking these senators, do you agree with what Senator Corker is saying? But at what point do we have to endure this kind of theater where he throws out red meat to his base, which is extraordinary to think that as his numbers go down, now they're down to 32%, he throws the entire weight of the federal government to give the wish list to the shrinking minority of supporters. So we have a tyranny of the minority in this country. It's a most peculiar dynamic where the less popular Trump becomes, the less popular his policies become, the more he empowers his shrinking base.
Yeah, I would say, you know, his reality TV show, unfortunately, is reality itself for, you know, thousands of people who wish to come to this country because they need protection or they want to reunify with their family members, or they want to become a part of the strength of this country. And I think what he's offered to Congress is really insulting to not only to the Democrats, but to his own party, because he's not giving them something that they can negotiate from. So, you know, regardless of whatever their motivation is, I think what's obviously true is that it's ignoring the reality that we have an immigration system that is crying out for reform. And rather than being a true partner in those negotiations, he's offered a starting point that's anything but a start.
And again, I'm speaking with Wendy Young, who's the executive director of KIND, Kids in Need of Defense, the leading organization for the protection of unaccompanied children who enter the U.S. immigration system alone. Previously, he served as chief counsel on immigration policy in the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on Immigration, Border Security, and Refugees, and held immigration policy positions with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, the Women's Refugee Commission, the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, and the National Council of La Raza. So it seems to me that if you go back to when Senator McCain and President George W. Bush and the Democrats tried to do immigration reform, and it got scuttled by, I take it, the same kind of conservative base that Donald Trump is now essentially throwing his lot in with. What happened there? Obviously, this is something you've devoted a lot of your time and energy to, Wendy Young. What happened in the kind of zeitgeist where immigrants started to get demonized instead of welcomed?
Well, I think that, you know, the immigration system is highly complex. And I think, you know, trying to bring members of Congress together to unify around some, you know, core principles that should guide our immigration system is extraordinarily hard, regardless of when it's been tried. But having said that, I think that, you know, opinion polling shows that the American public generally does believe that we should have a viable immigration system. So I think, you know, we need to have to move beyond this kind of polarization and this vitriolic accusations against immigrant communities as if they're all here to commit crimes or violate our national security. That, in fact, is not the truth at all. So we need to sit down and find that middle ground. It's been done in past decades, and I think it can be done again.
Well, it's clearly, though, has it not been kind of racialized? Isn't that, I mean, there seems to be so many dog whistles going on here, it's hard not to see. I mean, for example, this current president launched his presidential bid by insulting Mexicans, saying they were rapists and murderers.
I think that's exactly right, and I think he's appealing to a base instinct that is, you know, clearly out there in our communities, but I don't believe it represents the American public or their beliefs on immigration. I think it's a very cynical approach to immigration, and it's certainly not going to, you know, advance the ball down the field in terms of achieving true reform that people can feel comfortable with.
But having stirred these people up and done, if this is more like not a dog whistle, this is a dog siren or something, having stirred up these people, and he's serving this constituency, and again, I still can't figure out how you could have this tyranny of the minority in this country where a increasingly unpopular president is throwing the entire weight of his administration and the federal government behind a minority of angry Americans. But once you've stirred them up, you've scapegoated these minority communities, how do you turn it around and start healing this divide?
I really think it's going to be up to the leadership in Congress on both sides of the aisle. I think the administration is clearly, with this letter that they put out yesterday, they've clearly staked the ground that they feel that they're, for whatever reason, is the starting point for the discussion for them. So I think we've really got to shift our attention to Congress and come up with some solutions that are meaningful. The leadership's not going to come out of this White House, clearly.
But what can Democrats do if there is a constituency out there that, there's a lot of hand-wringing over how the Democrats lost the white working class, and isn't that a part of this constituency that's concerned that they're losing jobs to immigrants?
Yeah, I think that that sentiment is out there clearly, but I think that the reality is that immigrants contribute to our society. They create jobs, they pay taxes, they enrich our economy. So I think, designing an immigration system that capitalizes and builds on that, enhances that, is the way to go. I also think it's important to keep in mind that, there's really kind of three legs to the stool of our traditional immigration policy. One is, labor and employment visas. Second is family-based immigration. And the third are humanitarian programs, such as the treatment of unaccompanied children, refugee resettlement, and our asylum systems. And I think that those three legs, if you will, have really stood well for us over time. So we need to remind ourselves that that really should be the starting point for principles to guide this discussion.
But the work that you do on the unaccompanied minors, and largely coming from three countries, El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala, all of which are victims in many ways of Cold War foreign policy. And just recently, there have been some alarming stories about Honduras, the criminality of former leadership. There's a huge drug dealer now that's cooperating, naming names, and he's killed a whole bunch of people, but he may end up getting off. Isn't there some kind of responsibility on the part of the U.S.? It's almost like the Iraq War. George W. Bush, Dick Cheney and company, Condoleezza Rice, etc., they all marched in there in this macho way that they were going to settle scores with a dictator, and they ended up causing enormous chaos in the Middle East. And perhaps a million people died, at least, and they've sort of, it's like drive-by diplomacy. They've walked away and let the chips fall and don't seem to have any real concern about the collateral damage. I think you can also make the case that we got so involved in Central America in the 1980s and essentially have walked away. And until those countries provide security and a decent life for their citizens, won't we always have this problem of them wanting to flee violence and find a better life somewhere else?
Absolutely. Truly, the long-term solution to the refugee crisis that's unfolded in the Northern Triangle of Central America and those three countries you mentioned, Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, is really to address the root causes that's driving people out of those countries to begin with. And really, that violence is very much tied to gangs and narco-trafficking. And a lot of that is intrinsically tied in to the U.S.'s involvement in the region historically, and also the fact that we deported a lot of gang members over the years that went back to their home countries and just reestablished their criminal activity. But what that's led to is a level of instability in those countries that means that people can't seek protection in their home country, even if they want to. Governments are too weak or too corrupt to control the violence. Law enforcement can't get a handle on it, and entire communities are literally being taken over by this kind of activity. So people do what refugees do around the world. They flee for their lives. They seek safety elsewhere. And the U.S. has a strong tradition and a strong obligation to afford people protection when they need it.
But surely, since we are the market for drugs, and if narco-trafficking has destabilized these countries, and that's my understanding that in many ways, certainly Guatemala and Honduras are kind of narco-democracies. To some extent, I suppose El Salvador is a kind of gangland or street gang democracy, if you want to use those kind of analogies, the fact that we are the market for these drugs here in the United States, and doesn't that imply a certain responsibility on our part? I mean, I know that the war on drugs is not actually succeeding in dealing with that inherent problem of why Americans need to take drugs, but nevertheless, the reality is that this is where the demand for drugs is, and we can't pretend that there's only organized crime and mayhem in these other countries when we're in many ways responsible for causing it, as long as we have this drug habit.
Yeah, I would agree that not only is it our responsibility, but it's in our best interest to get control over the violence in this region, because these are cartels that are really transnational in nature now, so the instability could easily affect the United States if we don't assist those countries in getting their feet on the ground and reestablishing the rule of law.
Well, tell us about the kind of kids that you save, you know, kids in need of defense. I mean, this horrible letter, which feels like a cynical stunt on the part of Donald Trump and the one person who apparently really has influence over him, Stephen Miller. They managed to purge most of the extremists around Trump, but Stephen Miller is certainly still there. And as you know, he's a protege of Attorney General Sessions, and they're, you know, really have this obsession about immigration and trying to purify, make America white again, I guess, is to borrow their catchphrase. Put a human face on what's happening there, if you will, because I think that's what's lacking in this entire debate is just basic, simple humanity.
Sure. Well, every day I walk into my office, I see kids ranging in age from toddlers to teenagers. I see three-year-olds who are in deportation proceedings and are not afforded lawyers to help them through those proceedings, and the stakes are very, very high. Children without counsel are five times more likely to be ordered deported back to their home country to face that kind of violence that we just talked about. We have an increasing number of girls who are seeking our assistance, who the majority of whom have been raped by gangs, abducted, held, gang raped. I mean, these are kids who are really getting caught in the crossfire of this vicious violence that's going on in Central America, and their families and themselves are running for their lives. So, you know, I wish I could take President Trump into my office and introduce him to one of those toddlers and then ask him what he wants to do with our immigration policy.
Well, just in closing, I understand that even to get here, to get to the point where they are now being put in jeopardy, the kids in need of defense that you deal with, Wendy Young, they've run the gauntlet through Mexico, and that's extraordinary in itself in terms of the violence and that they faced on the journey to get here.
That's absolutely right. And the same cartels that are causing the violence in their home countries are often the ones involved in getting the kids here, and they're subject to rape, abduction, all sorts of human rights abuses as they try to navigate north, which really just underscores how desperate they are to get here, because they're well aware of the dangers of the trip, but they'd rather die on the way here than die in their home country.
Well, Wendy Young, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Wendy Young, who's Executive Director of KIND, Kids in Need of Defense, the leading organization for the protection of unaccompanied children who enter the U.S. immigration system alone. Previously, she served as Chief Counsel on Immigration Policy in the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on Immigration, Border Security, and Refugees, and held immigration policy positions with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, the Women's Refugee Commission, the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, and the National Council of La Raza. We're going to take a restation break and back exploring the growing tyranny of the minority in America as an increasingly unpopular president whose approval rating continues to shrink throws the full weight of his administration behind satisfying the wish lists of right-wing extremists and religious zealots.
There's a place where I've been told every street is paved with gold, and it's just across the border line.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Gretchen Borschelt, who is the Vice President for Reproductive Rights and Health at the National Women's Law Center, where she oversees the center's advocacy, policy, and education strategies to promote the quality and availability of healthcare, including reproductive health care. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gretchen Borschelt.
Thank you for having me.
And there's a peculiar sort of disconnect going on in this country where it seems that as Donald Trump becomes less popular and he's down to about 32% now in terms of the polls, the less popular he is, the more he gives away and puts the power of the government behind his shrinking base. And that seems to be a complete contradiction to the fundamentals of democracy, which is, it's not based on minority rule, as far as I know. So do you have an explanation for why this is happening, that as he gets less popular, the more zealous kinds of minorities in this country are the ones that get the full weight and benefits of the federal government in terms of their wish list?
Yeah, I think there's two things going on here on this particular issue, which is taking birth control away from women. One is that they tried and failed repeatedly to repeal the Affordable Care Act. They couldn't do it. It was unpopular. People were outraged. And so what they've done now is basically created an end run around the requirement in the Affordable Care Act that women get birth control coverage. And so it's a way for him to satisfy part of his base, even though they can't repeal the Affordable Care Act. He's basically just created this giant loophole where any employer, for any religious or moral reason, gets out of providing birth control coverage and leaving women without what they need. So I think that's one part of it. And then I think the other part is that this administration has always made clear that they were going to prioritize religious liberty, what they think of as religious liberty. And it's one viewpoint. And so what he's doing is letting employers with their religious beliefs override the views and beliefs and healthcare needs of their employees. And that's something that we're seeing not only when it comes to women's rights, but across the board. They also, on the same day they let employers get out of the birth control coverage, they issued huge new religious liberty guidance for the entire administration and all the agencies. We're going to see how that plays out, but I think what we're going to see is across the board, if people want to discriminate in the name of religion, this administration is going to let them do that.
But at least the law recognizes religion, and the Supreme Court, of course, did rule on this issue. But there's no legal standing for morality, is there? Morality is a very amorphous term, as far as I can tell. It seems like a very specious and thin reed to pin. I mean, obviously, employers will take advantage of it to save money. I mean, isn't it easier for employers to say, I have a moral objection, whatever that means? And particularly in the law, and you're a lawyer, so does it have standing in the law?
You're exactly right. But what this rule does, the Trump administration is letting any employer get out of providing birth control coverage for religious or moral reasons, and moral reasons isn't defined. And so who knows what an employer is going to try and hide behind morality, cost concerns, anything else. We could just open the floodgates here in terms of the kinds of things that employers might cite to try and get out of this, but claiming its morality. So that's a real concern, is how many employers now are going to step forward. But even on the religious point, it's true that the law has recognized free exercise of religion, but the law has also said you can't use your religious beliefs to harm somebody else. And here, the Trump administration is recognizing one set of religious beliefs, which also is not allowed. They can't establish one religion over everybody else, but not only are they recognizing that religion, they're allowing that to be used to harm others. That's why we are filing a lawsuit against these rules, because they are against the Constitution, they're against other laws. What they're doing is wrong, and we're going to try and stop them.
Well, I believe the Attorney Generals of Massachusetts and California are also suing. So give us a sense, Gretchen Borschelt, of the likely effect of these lawsuits.
Yeah, we think we all have very strong legal claims. So we are filing, the ACLU has filed suit. As you mentioned, the attorneys general in California and Massachusetts have filed suit. There are going to be others stepping forward representing women, because hundreds of women across the country could lose access to birth control coverage here. So we are going to be representing some women. Others are as well. State's attorney general are worried about their residents. And we have very strong claims under the Constitution, under the process they should have followed. They did this rule without following the normal process. They didn't propose it and take notice and comment, which is what you should usually do. They just said, we're doing this, and it's going into effect right away. So women could lose their birth control coverage immediately. That is not okay under the law. So we think we all of these lawsuits that you're going to hear about, have really a strong basis, and we think we're going to be able to stop this rule.
And again, I'm speaking with Gretchen Borschelt, who's Vice President for Reproductive Rights and Health at the National Women's Law Center, where she oversees the center's advocacy, policy, and education strategies to promote the quality and availability of healthcare, including reproductive health care. Now, when you say that earlier, Gretchen, that they failed, the Republicans, to repeal and replace Obamacare after endless tries, and particularly in the Senate, they've obviously fallen short. But that hasn't stopped Tom Price, even though he's been fired by Trump. He apparently was sabotaging it very effectively just through administrative tricks. For example, cutting the budget for advertising the ACA's benefits to Americans and cutting the enrollment times and doing everything he could. And I believe he has been effective. And I believe that Trump is now going to weigh in on the executive level and come up with executive branch means to try and kill it. So it doesn't seem like we're out of the woods in terms of the ACA.
No, I think that's a really good point, and I think people need to realize that it's not just what Congress can do or not do on the Affordable Care Act, that the executive agencies, the Trump administration itself, has a lot of power here to do things through regulation, through money-making or not giving money to a program, through its administrative powers. And so you've already mentioned some of what we've seen. They've shortened the open enrollment period, so people have less time to pick plans. They're not advertising. There's not enough money going to the people who help folks sign up for these plans and understand the plan offerings. And so across the board, we've seen this administration do whatever it can to undermine the Affordable Care Act. And they want it to fail. The president's been very clear that he's said, I'll just let Obamacare fail and then people will come running to me and I'll be seen as the savior. I think that's his ultimate goal, is to be a savior by actively undermining the Affordable Care Act and letting people get hurt. And that's not the kind of president this country needs.
Well, it's the president we have, and I think in many ways it's more to do with his ego than, I don't know that he can attribute any kind of ideology or belief system so much as he wants to win at any cost. So how is this going to translate, do you think, given that most people are very concerned about their health care, and if they're going to start losing it, it's certainly going to get people's attention. And also, I think a huge majority of women in this country use birth control, and they're going to have to pay for it, and it's expensive. And ironically, by any reasonable measure, if you make contraceptives less available, the unwanted pregnancy rate goes up, and therefore, as a consequence, the incidence of abortion goes up. There's a great way to get rid of the problem of abortion, which some people feel passionately about, and that is to make contraception readily available and make abortion as rare as possible. So there's something completely illogical about what's going on. It gets back to my first puzzlement, which is how come the minority in this country gets their wish list while the majority gets shafted?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think you're right that what we're seeing here is an effort to undermine people's access to what we thought was a fundamental right, right? It's unbelievable in 2017 that we're having a fight about whether or not women should have birth control. But a minority view has taken hold, has the presidency, has these levers in government, and is able to enact into policy these really extreme, dangerous views that are going to leave people without fundamental rights, fundamental health care. And the rule itself, you know, the justification for it, they actually contradicted everything you just said. They said birth control is not proven to prevent unintended pregnancy. So if you believe that, which is an outrageous claim that goes against decades of research, if that's your actual belief, then you see nothing wrong with getting rid of birth control. It's a backwards view that is really in the minority but has taken over all of the powers of government.
Well, it could get worse, though, even if, as I say, we have the tyranny of the minority going on now. But Trump's also appointing extreme people to the federal courts. This professor from Notre Dame is going to be on the important appeals court, the important appeals court that's just one rung below the Supreme Court. And she's an anti-abortion zealot, a real fundamentalist Catholic, and on top of that, she's hostile to LGBTQ rights. So that's an important court that she's on, and that she could have an effect. So, and he's got, I think, over 100 or so court appointments open in the federal judiciary. So Trump can shape the federal judiciary in an extremely reactionary way to make this problem worse in terms of the tyranny of the minority.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the courts are so important. I'm so glad you mentioned that. We are working hard to try and stop some of those judicial nominees because of the extreme views. You mentioned one in particular, Barrett. She's going to be nominated to the Seventh Circuit, or has been nominated to the Seventh Circuit, and she has extreme views, including calling birth control laws that require coverage a violation of religious liberty. So she holds the view that was just enshrined into this dangerous rule that the Trump administration has passed. And certainly we know that another Supreme Court fight is pending, right? That some of the justices are thinking about retiring. And so we already have a terrible new Supreme Court Justice Gorsuch, who has already started to make his outrageous and extreme views known on the court, and we're looking at possibly others. So it's right that it's not just the executive branch, but our judicial branch could be taken over shortly by terrible, terrible nominees with extreme views that then become the law.
So how do we get some wins here? How do you reverse this anomaly? I keep referring to it as the tyranny of the minority. I can't think of a better way to describe it. Is the majority not paying attention? What's going on here?
Well, one good thing we've seen is the outrage among people when Trump does things like this. And even we've had a holiday weekend here. You know, they announced this rule on birth control Friday, right before a holiday weekend. And despite that, when we publicized it, when we asked people to take action, we asked people to tweet at Trump, we asked people to make noise, and they did. People are outraged. So the outrage is there among the public. I think that needs to be translated into, really people marching and taking action and letting their voice be heard in other ways. But we're starting to see that real groundswell come up and move up and start to translate into action. The other thing that's important to note is that the states have a role here. We already mentioned that some of the state attorneys general has stepped forward to sue Trump over this birth control rule. And we know that there are state legislators who are stepping forward to pass laws in their own states to protect their residents and basically undo what they can at the state level when Trump tries to push things backwards. So I think it's a combination of strategies that we need to shore up legal rights and protections at the state level to make sure that people are having their voice heard, and ultimately to really fight for what we believe in, whether it's in the courts or in state legislatures or in Congress. We can't give up on our members of Congress. You know, I think we saw from the Affordable Care Act fight that when they hear from enough of their constituents that something they're considering would be harmful and dangerous, then some of them are going to back down.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Representative Trent Franks from Arizona pushed through this 20-week abortion ban. And of course, by the way, I saw him on CNN over the weekend. I couldn't believe what he was saying about the shooting in Las Vegas. He was asked about the possible ban of bump stocks that allowed this shooter to fire spray bullets in automatic fire and kill all those people and wound all those people. And even the NRA is coming out suggesting that maybe they should ban bump stocks. She asked him, the reporter or the interviewer said, you know, would you ban bump stocks? And he refused to answer and kept saying that the shooter actually had a machine gun, which is not true. and that's illegal. Of course it's illegal. It's been illegal since 1986. But that's the NRA talking point, that we already have the laws on the books and they're not being enforced, so we don't need new laws. That was his, he was repeating the NRA talking points, but lying through his teeth about what the shooter had. And we know that the shooter had 12 automatic assault rifles with bump stocks, and that's why he was able to fire so many bullets. Then Trent Franks then segues into abortion by saying that this terrible killer, in effect, is a part of the overall social problem caused by abortion, where he equated the murder in Las Vegas with people who support abortion. And I was frankly dumbfounded, and I can't believe that these conspicuously self-described Christians in this country are able to lie with such alacrity.
Yeah, well, we've seen lies become normalized in this administration in a way I think we've never seen before. And the political ideology and the agenda that they're pushing, right, they want to ban abortion altogether. They want to get rid of access to birth control. And clearly they're going to take whatever steps they can and make whatever connections, as outrageous and untrue as they are, they're always just going to pivot back to what they think their base wants. And that's really the danger here, is that they're pushing forward these policies based not on evidence, not on the facts, not on science, but based on a political ideology. And that's true of the abortion ban that just passed the House of Representatives. The American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists oppose it because it's not based on sound science, and it criminalizes abortion providers, and it's unreasonable and unfair to women. It's dangerous to women. But they're going to push it forward because they think that's what their base wants, and they're looking for votes, frankly. And so that's the situation we have here. And it's why so many people need to get engaged and to speak up and to let their voice be heard on the other side. Because if we just let that be the new normal, then our lives are all going to suffer because of it.
Well, Gretchen Borschelt, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Gretchen Borschelt, who's the Vice President for Reproductive Rights and Health at the National Women's Law Center, where she oversees the center's advocacy, policy, and education strategies to promote the quality and availability of healthcare, including reproductive healthcare. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared by